It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, there's famous and there's internet famous. Find out how a whole generation of celebrities has emerged on platforms like TikTok and Instagram, and how younger users are driving that fame. First, Americans' trust in the federal government has generally been on the decline over the past several decades. Pew Research Center has been asking people if they trust the federal government to do what's right at least most of the time. In 1964, 77% said yes. 2 months ago, that figure was down to 24% and approaching a record low. Meanwhile, faith in local government has remained consistently high, right around 70%, according to Gallup. But our next guest says he sees some cracks in the foundation. He sees the, quote, poisonous polarization at the federal level is starting to flow downhill. And if it's not properly addressed, the ability of local officials to provide the services that citizens have come to expect could be in trouble. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you feel about the government in your community? Do you generally trust it or not? What do you think of the job your local officials have done with the pandemic? What are you looking for in your local government? If you work in a local government, are you sensing that the public's trust is beginning to wear down, or is it still strong? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Don Kettle is Professor Emeritus at the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin, former Dean of the School of Public Policy at the University of Maryland, and a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Used to work at UW-Madison, and he recently wrote about the fragile bond between residents and local officials for the website Governing. Don, welcome back to the show.
Hi there, Rob. It's great to be with you and with all my friends there in Wisconsin.
Well, let's start with those numbers on the federal government. I don't think it's a huge surprise to people, but what is behind that decline in trust from, say, early 60s to now?
Yeah, it really is dramatic. And from 77% during the Johnson administration to 24% today is just a precipitous decline. And there's a variety of reasons behind that. In part, it's that the public doesn't tend to trust federal institutions as much as it used to. In part, Watergate and then a series of economic problems have eroded that. But the thing is that at the federal level, it's mainly a matter of a kind of wholesale trust, how we look at the government as a whole and whether or not we feel connected to it. And so part of the reality also is that we don't have a whole lot of direct dealings with the federal government most of the time for most of us. And so the challenge is trying to figure out how we can connect to the pieces of government that we really do care about and how we can use that as the foundation for building trust.
But local governments, they're the ones who hopefully are filling our potholes and answering our calls to the fire department and that kind of thing. Why has trust there stayed, at least up till now, stayed so high while the federal government's trust levels have gone down?
Yeah, it really is fascinating, isn't it, that trust at the local level has remained almost unmoving at 70% for the last generation. And the reason, I think, is a pretty simple one. The federal government may seem like it's far and distant, and we're not really sure exactly what it is that it does for most of us in our daily lives. We just can't go out of our front doors without encountering local governments, without encountering garbage collection, without encountering police and fire, with people who are in charge of rescue squads, the traffic lights and the potholes and the highways, the water and the sewer, the pieces of government that we care most about, that we interact with most of the time, turns out to be things that people really value, and they really trust the people who provide it, as long as that relationship is in fact trustworthy, as long as in fact the public officials who are in charge are open and sensitive and accountable and deliver value for taxpayer dollars. But it's a lot easier to see what we get from local government than it is from the federal government. And that's a big part of the reason why trust is so different, has remained so fundamentally different over time.
You're worried, though, Don, about a trickle-down effect, as you write in this piece in Governing magazine. Why are you worried that this distrust in federal government may make its way down to our local governments?
What we've really seen, Rob, is in the last, especially in the last year with COVID, we've seen a dramatic shift in the way in which people have looked at government as a whole. And a lot of the polarization that we've seen at the national level, especially on issues having to do with public health and the pandemic, has begun to filter down to the local level as well. We've seen an incredible phenomenon where About 250 public health officials across the country have left their jobs because they just simply couldn't take it anymore because of the enormous tension and pressure and conflict that has come up around the question of whether or not to wear masks, what parts of the economy to open. If you think about that, that's 250 experts who are simply not there in place anymore to be able to do what we need them to do to be able to keep us safe. And that's just really a sign of things. So there's tales about, for example, a doctor named Cameron Kaiser in Riverside, California. And he, given the circumstances that they had early on, issued some lockdown orders really in advance of what was happening nationally and what the state was arguing. And he ended up getting attacked, not only in terms of name calling, but citizens really marched on his on a county board meeting, accused of trampling on the Constitution. Some created a fake Twitter account featuring his picture with a Hitler-style mustache and a caption of Führer Kaiser. It just was amazing about the kind of personal vitriol that is in many ways gone to the people who have been trying to work on these public health issues. And so what we've seen is that the basic issues of trust that have always been around filling potholes and putting out fires has now gotten so full of conflict when it comes to dealing with these issues of public health in the middle of the pandemic.
Talking to Don Kettle from the University of Texas at Austin about a piece he wrote on trust in government. It's gone down for the federal government a lot over the years. He's worried now that that's going to happen at the local level, too. And you could join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on your local government. Or if you work, if you're on a city council, if you're a mayor or you participate in local government, love to hear your perspective at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. CJ is with us in Racine. CJ, hi.
Hi, thanks for having me on. I'm actually a new alderman in the city of Racine, along with my mother. And I'm definitely resonating with a lot of what you're saying. I feel a lot of that almost violent partisan divide that comes from the federal government seeping down to the local level. But as now, there is an easy solution that I found, and it's just the humanity aspect of it. Getting out and speaking with those people, especially those ones who might say things about you that aren't true. If you can speak with them and get to know them, it's easy to push past that national divide and remind them, like, hey, I deal with potholes. I deal with snow plows. How can I help you? I live here, too. I'm your neighbor. What can I do for you? And that divide tends to vanish as soon as we can regain that sense of connection, which was really hard during COVID, but we're working on that back.
CJ, what are there particular issues where you see that, you know, national-style partisanship hitting you there in Racine?
Oh, yeah. COVID was a huge one. We are one of the unique cities in this state of Wisconsin that have our own health department, that have our own director of health department as well, and she received a lot of attacks, still receives a lot of attacks. But a lot of it tends to come from people that are either not within our jurisdiction, whether they come in the surrounding county, or again, just need that personal connection. And we're small enough, even though we are a city, we're small enough to be able to reach out.
CJ, thanks a lot. Don, CJ gave us a lot to talk about there. First of all, that CJ pointing toward a way to maybe keep that trust or rebuild it. Go out and talk to your neighbors if you're in city government. What do you think?
I think CJ's exactly on the right course here, because there are two things that we've learned. One is that at the local level, it's possible to create that person-to-person contact. So instead of having this distant, indistinct federal government with an uncertain kind of role, there's a personal face on things. And so that's one thing for sure. And the other is that the kind of services that local governments provide are things that people want to get done, that there really isn't a Democratic or Republican, a blue versus red way of filling potholes. Nobody is going to deny someone access to an ambulance if it turns out that they're a Republican or a Democrat. Those are the basic kinds of services that everybody wants, expects, and boy, do they appreciate it when they get it, too, on top of that. So the big advantage here at the local level is the ability to make that personal contact, to talk about the things that people care most about, and use that as a foundation. And actually, there's some research on this. McKinsey, the global consulting firm, finds that 2/3 of the amount of trust in government can be explained by that basic interaction between citizens and the government officials who serve them. And so if that's positive, then they tend to have trust in that government official and trust in government. So this is international research that bolsters what CJ is finding and what he's doing. That's the great advantage that there is. But the problem, of course, is that COVID has just made all that so much harder. And without the kind of extra effort that officials like CJ are putting out, it's going to be that much harder to try to not only rebuild trust, but to maintain the trust that local governments have.
CJ also brought up this interesting notion that the way outrage works now, if a local government ends up on the internet and some partisan player on Twitter or whatever is stirring up outrage and putting a bullseye on a local government or a partisan radio host or whatever, that can lead to a lot of this partisanship being focused at the local level, as CJ said, sometimes not even by people who are constituents at that local level.
Well, that's exactly right, because one of the things that tends to be handy these days is that you can create Twitter accounts, Facebook feeds, and other kinds of social media connections that are completely disconnected. They can be anonymous, and they can be incredibly vicious. And that's, in fact, what happened to the doctor that I mentioned from Riverside, California, that you can find yourself the target of that, stirred up, whether it's by talk radio or by what people read in the newspapers or online or what they hear on TV. And that's leading, unfortunately, to greater divisions and, frankly, to a fair amount of incivility as well. And the more that that happens, the harder it is to be able to make that kind of connection. What local governments really have going for them is this basic fact that, you know, if I've never seen anybody who has had a house on fire says, you know what, I just don't believe in government at this point. Let the house burn down. I've been just amazed by the kind of services that local officials can perform and the kind of instant connection that happens on the whole wide variety of things. You make that work and trust flows from that. But it's just getting so much harder to do that because the way in which social media has poisoned the conversation and in some cases, unfortunately, has reduced the amount of civility that we have and that we need.
We're talking about threats to the public's trust in local government with Don Kettle, professor emeritus at the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. He wrote about this issue for the website Governing, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Do you trust your local government? Do you feel engaged with it in one way or another? Do you participate? Do you work in local government as an elected official or a staffer? What are your thoughts on these issues? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about people's trust in local government. It's remained at a high level, even as trust in the federal government has steadily gone down. Our guest says, though, there are cracks in the foundation. We need to work to repair them before it's too late. Don Kettle is professor emeritus at the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. He recently wrote about trust in local government for the news website Governing. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on your local government, whether you're a citizen or a staff member or an elected official, school board, city council, county board, you name it, 800-642-1234 is the number to call. We'll go back to your calls now. Walton is with us in Koshkonong. Walton, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. So this is an interesting show. It really strikes a chord with me. I've been a local official for about 18 years, starting in 1997 as a town board, town of Koshkonong board supervisor, and now a county board supervisor, and I'm on both those boards right now. And over the years, I have really observed the beauty of not having to worry about any kind of partisan consideration as we debate, you know, how much money to put into the road budget or, you know, how to hire somebody at the county level for some position or whatever in the board and the budget, all those housekeeping duties that we do every month. Nothing about partisan politics gets in there. I mean, really, I don't remember any event, any circumstance where somebody made a Democratic or Republican argument in favor of something. And that is how things have really moved smoothly. We've gotten our work done. So the idea that somebody might think, oh, we're going to start trying to make it more like Madison or the United States Congress would, that would really make me angry if somebody to make that argument, because it works well the way it does, the way we have it right now.
Well, thanks a lot for that call. And down here in Wisconsin and in a lot of places, the sort of agency, the sort of units of government that Walton was talking about are nonpartisan elections. You wouldn't run as a Democrat or Republican. Does that make a difference? Keeping out the labels maybe keeps some of the partisanship out?
No, I think it helps in two respects. First, it helps in at least not instantly polarizing the debate. And that, I think, is a big plus. But the other is, if you listen to what Walton was saying about the kinds of things that he does, about trying to figure out where to put a road or how much money to budget for utility repairs, those are the kinds of things that people really care about. Of course, nobody wants to pay more taxes than they have to. But when you pay taxes at the local level, you've got a pretty good sense about where that money is going. And that, with luck, tends to help bring some of the partisanship and polarization out of the basic business of local government. And it's one of the reasons why trust is so much higher. And in some ways, too, even though we know we've got huge problems of trust and civility in the United States, this is one of the things that really makes me most hopeful, because the kind of work that CJ is doing, the kind of work that Walton is doing, shows that we can just rebuild that one brick at a time by really focusing on the kinds of things that taxpayers care about and demonstrating that they're getting value for the money that they're spending.
Thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Don Kettle, government expert, former Wisconsinite, looking at trust in local government. He's worried that that could go away. Back to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Jim is next in La Crosse. Jim, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about, Jim?
Well, I worked in public health for 35 years, and I noticed a distinct change after Act 10 had passed. And in general, a lot of people lost interest in local government and became hostile toward the employees.
Jim, thanks a lot for the call. Don, Jim felt kind of targeted by what was going on at the state level in our politics here.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that really, I was talking about what it is that really makes me feel hopeful. What Jim described is one of the things that makes me worried, which is that some of the same kind of incivility, some of the same kind of personal attacks that have started to happen at the federal level are beginning to trickle down to the local level as well, and are beginning to get in the way of that critical relationship between citizens and government officials. If we start out by not trusting each other, if we start out with incivility, if we start out with criticism, it makes it that much harder to try to build the trust on which everything depends. And it's, you could get too apocalyptic about this, but if we're going to try to pass a strong and vibrant democracy on to our kids and grandkids, it's got to be based on a system of trust, on the fact that we can find ways of governing ourselves and sharing power about what we want government to do in a way that we trust government to do it well. And that's why this relationship at the local level is so important, and why what Jim describes in some ways is also concerning. This is an opportunity we have now to try to stop it before it gets worse. And the way to do that is by following the kinds of things that some of our local officials have already described.
Thanks a lot for that call, Jim. Will joins us next in Chippewa Falls. Will, hi.
Hello.
What did you want to bring up, Will?
Well, I know earlier on in the show, they had mentioned that there's no bipartisan in filling potholes. I want to make a comment, and this is wholeheartedly true, that Democrats want to fill those potholes with the sales from pot. Republicans want to fill those holes with tax dollars. That is bipartisan. And I think if anybody wants this state to fill those potholes, fix infrastructure, hashtag pot for potholes.
Well, thanks for the call. We're getting into a particular issue there, but he points to that idea that maybe partisanship can sneak into these practical, how do you do a thing and how do you pay for it issues.
Well, that's absolutely right, Rob, because no matter what you do there, it's the question of, if you've got a pothole, do people think that you fill somebody else's pothole first? If it snows, are you confident that your neighbor is going to get a fair shake compared to somebody else's? Or the Republican neighborhood's going to get plowed out first, or maybe Democratic neighborhoods get plowed out first. And that's the foundation of trust that people, I think, have to be able to rely on. But one of the things that many local governments are doing, for example, is to create transparency with us by putting transponders into the snowplows, for example, so that you can track where the plow is and which roads are open and which ones are being plowed now, so the citizens can see what's going to happen. And the more transparency and the more civility that we bring to the process, the easier it's going to be to try to ensure that people have trust in what it is that they're paying for and with the kind of services that they're getting.
Thanks for the call, Will. And our last minute, Don, a little curveball here. We've talked on the show a lot about the decline of local media, you know, those smaller town papers that provide the sort of day-to-day coverage of local government. Do you think that that might hurt, that might make people feel less connected if they aren't up to date like that?
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that more broadly on both a local, state, and even a national level is a growing issue, I think. We have fewer local papers that are out there. There are fewer local papers that have reporters in state capitals. There's less reporting in general about state politics and more an effort to try to focus on the big national stories through big national chains. And what that does in a way is it makes it harder for people to be able to draw that line between where they sit in the neighborhood where they live and the kind of services that are being provided and the people who are making those decisions for them. I think we'd have a much healthier democracy if we had, in fact, more local papers and more local reporting on state politics and better state government reporting as well. And that's one of the reasons why I've always thought that Wisconsin Public Radio provides such a service, because it connects people across the state to a set of realities and provides a way for the conversations to happen. But in so many places, there's just not that kind of conversation happening. And there's a growing disconnect between the print media and what's happening in places at the state and local level. And that makes it that much easier for social media to define the way in which the conversations happen. And that's one of the things in the list of things that I worry most about, is one of the things that's going to make it hardest to try to recover.
Don, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us again today.
So good to be with you, Rob.
Don Kettle is a professor emeritus at the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin, formerly with UW-Madison. Talk to him today about the public's maybe fragile trust in local government and how to bring it back. Coming up after the news, what would you do if something you posted online suddenly got millions of views? We'll find out what it means to be internet famous. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show, Milwaukee's airport is adding routes with the expectation of more travel in the years ahead. Find out what's going on in the sky tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Now, the internet has opened up new avenues to being famous. You don't need to be, for example, a Hollywood star for people to know who you are. And being famous on the internet can get you attention in other areas like TV deals, record deals, brand partnerships, and other potential big money gigs. But just like other kinds of fame, it's not always clear what the road to success is. Our next guest helps us understand the modern internet celebrity. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you or someone you know aspire to be internet famous in some way? Are you a regular viewer or follower of big-time influencers or TikTok stars? Do you have a generation gap in your household where some people, maybe the younger ones, know about this category of famous person and they are, quote, alien to you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Kate Eichhorn is chair and associate professor of culture and media at the New School in New York. She's the author of several books on this field, including her latest, The End of Forgetting, Growing Up with Social Media. Kate, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for the invitation.
Well, internet celebrity seems like kind of a unique kind of celebrity in that, you know, if somebody's like a young famous movie star, I might not know who they are, but I'll see their pictures on magazines in the grocery store or whatever. with internet, with a TikTok star, say they might be intensely famous with one group and completely anonymous to another. What do you make of that sort of maybe generation gap or technology gap in celebrity?
Yeah, it's really quite unique to our time. There are stories of parents who find out that their kids have, you know, 200, 300, half a million followers on a digital platform, and they had no idea that their 13 or 14 year old had actually generated this sort of following. Sometimes they find out when managers call them up and let them know and want to start working with their kids in a sponsorship fashion. So that is really quite unique. And it's not all negative. I mean, for many, you know, basically until this point in history, children and adolescents had very few opportunities to record their lives and share images of their lives widely. And so there's some very positive things that have come out of this. And then there's also a lot of really disturbing things that we can talk about if you want to go down that path.
Yeah, we can get into that in a minute. I want to take a tour, though, if you will, of some of the platforms that we're talking about the most. Where do these celebrities emerge on the internet?
It's changed. If you were talking to me 5 or 6 years ago, we might have been talking about Vine, and now people are like, what is Vine? Now we have TikTok. Obviously, Instagram is probably the most important platform, I'd say, right now, TikTok and Instagram. But it's important to remember that digital platforms come and go. Some of them stick around for a long time, but if we go back to, over a decade, people would have been talking about things like MySpace. So influencer culture seems to pivot around fairly fleeting digital platforms, would be my observation.
Is there a proven road for people looking to become celebrities? Because to me, it looks random. I mean, one, I understand, came about because people liked a video of her nodding her head along to music. Right. It could be just about anything. Lightning can strike anywhere in some ways.
Yeah, I wish I had an answer to that question. If I did, I could turn myself into an influencer and quit my day job as a university professor and just make money on TikTok. I don't know what it is. I think that I think you're right to point out that it can be quite random. In a way, though, historically, we've always had a certain small group of celebrities who just become famous for doing something that stands out in the moment, right? You can think about someone who, went over a barrel at Niagara Falls. They would fall into that category. There is, however, another category of influencer who is intentionally trying to become that digital celebrity and puts a lot of effort into it and cultivates a following and, turns it into a career, at least briefly.
And when we're talking about internet influencer culture and the internet celebrities, is it fair to say we're talking about youth culture too? It seems like there's a pretty big generation gap here.
I think in North America, the vast majority of internet celebrities and influencers are young. But it's interesting, I'm not an expert on this, but I've read a lot of articles recently about, in China, in Korea, there are a lot of older women, including, retired age women who are influencers and digital celebrities. So I think it depends a bit on the culture. But certainly in North America, it's a very, child and youth oriented activity. So we have parents who are putting their young children online without their permission because they're so young and turning them into celebrities. And then there are many adolescents and people in their early 20s who do this as a kind of full-time gig.
We're talking to Kate Eichhorn from the New School in New York. She's a social media expert. We're looking at the rise of internet fame and how people can become influencers and celebrities on venues like TikTok and Instagram. You could join in with your thoughts, your experiences, your questions at 800-642-1234. Do you yourself follow any famous people who are famous because of what they've done on TikTok, say, or Instagram? If you're a parent, do you see your kids following such celebrities? 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Kate, you mentioned a potential downside, dark side of the quest for internet fame. Can you talk about that a little?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's important to remember that these platforms are free and, you know, they need content. So who has the time and the sort of energy to produce all this free content for these tech companies? Well, young people do. So a lot of the exploitation that goes on as well, particularly, you know, I'd say one of the dominant demographics, if you look at influencer culture, are adolescent girls. And I think that there's a lot of exploitation that happens. It starts with somebody saying, you know, we like your content, we'll give you some free clothes or, you know, a free pair of shoes or some other product if you wear them in your next video. But unlike if we think about child actors, we have a lot of laws that govern, you know, when children can work, how many hours a week they can be on set, who handles their money. When you talk about influencer culture, it's very murky. There are very few regulations at all that protect children and adolescents who end up in that world. So that to me is something that one always has to be thinking about, particularly if they're watching these videos online, you know, who's benefiting really.
I know another concern you have for non-celebrities and celebrities alike is how much of their identity they put online, how much identity teens say put online when they're young and how much that sticks with them in later years. Do you have thoughts on that when it comes to, say, that adolescent who is seeking internet fame?
Yeah, it's an interesting question, particularly, you know, if you're 13 or 15, 17, and you decide that you're going to produce this content yourself and put it online, I think that's one thing. But we also have a lot of online celebrities are babies, children, kids who are, you know, still in elementary school. And in that case, their parents have driven this celebrity. They have not given permission or instigated it themselves. So one of my questions is, you know, when those kids grow up, how will they feel about the fact that their entire childhood was documented and widely circulated? And a lot of those images and videos are things that they'll never be able to take back. So as adults, they're going to have to live with this huge repository of everything they did and said when they were growing up. So Rob, like, can you imagine thinking back to your childhood if there were, you know, thousands of photographs, videos of you just, you know, being a kid? Would you want that out there?
I would not. Speaking for myself, I would absolutely not. Yeah.
Yeah. So that to me is, it's an interesting question. Will in another 10 years, 15 years, will we see these kids actually taking legal action against their parents? I think it's highly, highly possible.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. John is with us in Madison. John, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I formulated my thoughts before hearing that final segment. So I was wondering what other differences might there be between modern celebrities and previous ones? Because where I was coming from is this seems a lot like previous celebrities. You know, you have one-hit wonders, you have people that have a very small but devoted fan base, and you have people that have wide appreciation. The people that I was, you know, interested in, like the Vlogbrothers channel, they're older than I am right now, and there are celebrities that they are like, I'm sorry, I've never heard of them before. So it's kind of like the Simpsons meme, you know. It'll happen to you too. The new celebrities now will one day be older celebrities.
Gotcha. John, thanks a lot for the call. John, not seeing that much, you know, it's a different medium, but maybe not that different a phenomenon than the old celebrity. Kate, what do you think?
I think that on the one hand, you know, there are lots of parallels. But I would say that the thing that is mostly different, although we did, you know, at the beginning, I talked about, you know, someone going over Niagara Falls in a barrel. Okay. That would have been quite rare, though, that someone would have become a celebrity just for doing something very kind of unusual once. In our current culture, there's a sense that anybody can become a celebrity. You can just be sitting in your bedroom and make a very memorable video and post it and it can go viral. So the possibility of becoming a celebrity is greater now than it was in the past. And then also, I think the whole economic structure driving contemporary influencer structure, influencer culture is also really different. So those are the two differences. But I would agree with John, as someone who's really interested in history, that I don't think we should overdetermine the differences that mark the digital era.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Kate Eichhorn, Chair and Associate Professor of Culture and Media at the New School in New York. We're talking about internet fame and youth culture. She's the author of several books in the field, including her latest, The End of Forgetting, Growing Up with Social Media. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of internet celebrities? Do you think of internet celebrities? Are there people you follow on YouTube, TikTok, Instagram, say, who have millions of followers? Why do you follow them? Are you seeking to become internet famous in your own right? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with Kate Eichhorn, Chair and Associate Professor of Culture and Media at the New School in New York, author of the book The End of Forgetting, Growing Up with Social Media. We are talking about internet fame, how celebrities rise seemingly out of nowhere on platforms like TikTok or Instagram, maybe YouTube, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. Are you influenced by a particular influencer on those or other platforms? Do you want to be one yourself? Do you have questions about how all of this works? Do you worry that kids are seeking fame online and what they might encounter along the way? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Kate, just a few moments ago, you mentioned the economics of influencers and celebrities on these platforms. How does that work?
Well, I think that there are a variety of different ways in which people are able to monetize their content online. So if you're on YouTube, it's clicks and views. You're getting money, a very small portion. So you're basically sharing a lot of your profit with the tech platforms. And then there's also sponsorships. So it might start with sponsorships and a sponsorship that's just about, you know, giving you products that you then, you know, use or talk about in your videos. And then that can eventually turn into larger sponsorships where you're brought into, for example, a content house. I don't think you have content houses in the Midwest, but in places like Los Angeles, there are very successful TikTokers and Instagram influencers who actually just all live in the same house and they just produce content all day. But when you read the tales of these young people who end up working in content houses, what happens is they end up burning out really quickly and feeling this incredible stress to come up with original content basically 24/7. So they go from, you know, having the liberation of basically making, you know, running their own business and doing something really fun, but it sort of seems to quickly evolve into something that is disturbing and difficult and incredibly stressful and, you know, where they're not really owning their life anymore.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Marie is with us in Green Bay. Marie, hello.
Hi there. I wanted to comment about TikTok. I'm newer to the platform. I don't have any content. I don't have any interest in any content, but I do enjoy it. And I'll give you an example. I like the gardening videos, even though I've been gardening for 40 years, but I still feel like I can learn something new. There's information about animals and there is some politics, which I do listen to. But again, I'm more interested in animal nature, fauna and flora. So I think it's a great platform because it's quick and to the point, as opposed to Facebook where you have to read and read and read. I'm not opposed to reading, but again, it gives me, do I want to know about this? Do I not want to know about this? So I think it's a great platform.
Marie, thanks a lot for the call. Kate, can you talk about how TikTok will serve itself up to someone like Marie, who's clearly given it cues that she likes gardening and animal videos, for example?
No, it is true that for, you know, when we think about TikTok, we tend to think about, you know, a very particular kind of influencer culture. But there are people on TikTok who are, you know, doing how-to videos. There's a lot of crafting that happens on TikTok. And then it's also used as an activist platform as well. And that's also really interesting. So, you know, it will be interesting to see, too, how that platform evolves. Will it just reach, you know, a limit like Vine and other platforms and disappear? Or will it keep evolving like Instagram or Facebook? And that's yet to be seen.
Marie, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Kate, with teens putting a lot of their lives on social media, whether they want to be celebrities or not, I know there's concern that, you know, they may be too outwardly image focused and live trying to shape their lives in a way that's appealing online. I know teens being self-conscious about their appearance and how they come off in the world is not a new thing. Is this a worry you have?
You know, to come back to what I said at the beginning of our time, Rob, I think that on the one hand, it's incredibly exciting that for the first time in history, not only can teens take images of themselves, record their lives, but they can also broadcast those images to a few friends or to millions of people. It gives them a voice that they didn't have in the 20th century or even in the early 21st century. And that's something that, you know, we should be celebrating. On the other hand, the fact that they're putting all of that content out there and can't necessarily take it back or delete it is a bit disturbing to me, because things that you might feel okay about when you're 16 or 15 or 18 might be things that you don't want in circulation 10 years later or 20 years later. So that's my concern. Is the fact that one risks getting stuck in the past.
Kate, as you mentioned earlier, you've selected a field of study that is a moving target. It's constantly changing as platforms rise and evolve. What to you right now is the most interesting open question that we're still figuring out about social media and influencer culture?
I would say two things. One, to follow up on what I was just saying, I think that we really need to think about the right to be forgotten, how to use those platforms in a way where we can have a bit more control over the content that we're producing. And this holds true for children and adolescents and for adults. I also think that, you know, something I've been thinking about recently is we talk about influencers, but I wonder, you know, in the past, influence and power tended to be connected. And I think in our current culture, having influence doesn't necessarily mean you have more power in the world. So I do worry a bit about the different ways in which young influencers are not powerless, but perhaps vulnerable or at risk. So those are two kind of worries I have. But it's not to say that I think all these platforms are necessarily inherently problematic. Absolutely not.
Kate, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for your time, Rob.
Kate Eichhorn is chair and associate professor of culture and media at the New School in New York. She's the author of several books in the field, including her latest, The End of Forgetting, Growing Up with Social Media. She joined us for a look at what it means to be internet famous. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, it's our weekly look at the top stories in the nation's capital, including a possible compromise on a long-awaited infrastructure bill. After a vice presidential border visit and attention from leading Republicans, we'll look at the latest news on the U.S. border, the number of asylum seekers, and efforts at border enforcement and application processing. And we'll meet a Wisconsin family that takes in baseball players for the summer. That's coming up tomorrow on Central Time. Last Friday on the show, we talked to an astronomer about the release of U.S. government data on reports of unidentified flying objects. If you missed it, the conclusion was probably not aliens. But that's okay. You could still celebrate UFOs with not one, but three separate events here in Wisconsin. Chelsea Lewis with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, she's been on this show a time or five, wrote about Wisconsin's UFO celebrations in a new piece. You can find that at jsonline.com. Three places in Wisconsin claim a history of UFO sightings, at least three. In Dundee, between Fond du Lac and Sheboygan, between-ish anyway, a bar hosts an annual UFO Days, that's D-A-Z-E, event that's scheduled for July 17th this year. In Elmwood, west of Eau Claire, they celebrate UFO Days, spelled the normal way, in honor of sightings reported back in the mid-1970s. And Belleville, south of Madison, hosts its own UFO Days around Halloween, marking a sighting back in 1987. Whether you believe or not, whether you want to believe or not, one thing is true. You can do some pretty good UFO tourism without leaving the state. Interstellar tourism news you can use. This is Central Time.